Unfiltered, the official Sunderland AFC podcast.
Welcome to SAFC Unfiltered. Nick Barnes. Nick, you have a milestone coming up at the weekend. 1,000 games. You've commentated on Sunderland. Does it feel like 1,000 games?
Whoa, good question. Does it feel like 1,000 games? It does in a way, because when I think back, and any time you always talk about, you know, when I started covering Sunderland, and you look back at that time, it was Mick McCarthy, Danny Collins.
Yeah, I remember him.
Naren Nosworthy. And all those, and there's you just think how long ago was that? It feels like an epic.
That, yeah.
It was a long time ago. I mean, and there are a lot of waters passed under the bridge. So, I mean, it's been a roller coaster. But I think the starkest fact about 1,000 games covering Sunderland is that I've seen 19 managers in the 20 years I've actually been covering Sunderland per se. I did do some sort of games when Radio Newcastle were between commentators, so I was doing both Newcastle and Sunderland. So I did Sunderland games under Peter Reid, a fair few in the period, including when Sunderland could have gone top of the Premier League at West Ham. That 1-1 late goal, that late equaliser for West Ham, and then a 5-0 at Derby County as well, winning at Derby 5-0. So yeah, 20 managers.
Yeah. Good job you don't cover Watford then, isn't it?
I know. Crumbs, they've had 20 in the last 2 years, haven't they?
Well, that actually follows on quite nicely from our last SAFC Unfiltered, which was Sir Bob Murray, who of course would have been chairman at the time when you first covered Sunderland. But to give the listeners a little bit of an idea of your journey and how you came to commentate on Sunderland, am I right in thinking you grew up in Devon, though?
Yes. I grew up in Devon. Went away to university and, as you do, go back home. But I went back to Devon with no clear plan of what I was going to do.
What did you study at university?
English.
Okay. Safe.
Sets you up for everything, doesn't
yeah.
it? And then a friend of mine said, what are you doing for the summer? And I said, well, nothing. I've got nothing. Absolutely nothing planned. And this friend worked for the AA. Her father worked for the AA. He was head of the Automobile Association rather than the other one. And he said, look, we need someone to do the traffic news in the summer on Radio Devon, Devon Air, Plymouth Sound. And so I did that for 3 months. And then the boss at Radio Devon, the BBC station, said, look, we're looking for someone to do technical stuff in the studios as a freelance. Would you be happy to do that? I said, well, yeah, I've got nothing else. So I started working as a freelance at Radio Devon. And that was with the likes of Jill Dando and Alan Dedicote, voice of the Balls, Ben Bradshaw, who's now the MP for Exeter. He was the culture secretary. So we had some great people there. And I started doing technical stuff, but I actually, because I was interested in sport, they let me do sports reporting. So on a Saturday afternoon, I would do Exeter, Plymouth or Torquay for the away team. So if Stockport County were playing Exeter, I'd do it for Radio Manchester. Or if Wolves were playing, I'd do it for Radio WM. Because back in the day, this is the sort of mid to late 80s, nobody was really doing football commentary. They had sports shows, but it was all sports reports, through the afternoon, rather than
like
teams
updates.
Rather than doing commentary. Anyway, I was 2 years at Radio Devon and then wanted a staff BBC job, and one came up in Cumbria. So
that's quite a far way from Devon.
It shows you how desperate you are for a staff job in the BBC. You go anywhere, you know. It just so happened. It turned out to be Cumbria. So I moved to Cumbria. I got the job in Cumbria. Again, I wasn't doing sport at Radio Cumbria. I was doing everything, but I was presenting the religious programme, mornings, you know, you name it. Breakfast in Barrow, I was Whitehaven producer. You know, I was doing everything but sport, but I was helping out on the sports programmes. Now, the main sports programme at Radio Cumbria was on a Sunday afternoon because it was rugby league.
Yes.
So I started doing a lot of rugby league. I was actually doing rugby league commentary before I was doing football commentary.
Did you know the code before you did
the
commentary?
Nope. I mean, I got to know it because I was watching, going to games, and I loved it. Actually, I loved the rugby league. Really good community. There was a really good community in rugby league, and I'm not sure what it's like now because it's become so fragmented. But then it was brilliant. You know, I used to go and chew the cud with Cameron Bell, the Carlisle Border Raiders coach, whose son Dean Bell was the captain in New Zealand, and the old secretary Ray Edgar. We used to have an old shipping container or porter cabin down by the Carlisle ground, and the battered old armchairs, and they'd sit there with a cup of tea, mug of tea, and Ray would be there with a tab. And it was like, you know, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So I got sort of immersed in the sport there. And then the sports editor left, and I was the only one on the station with any real interest in sport. So they said, will you take it and will you pick it up? So I did. And I thought, look, you know, we're missing a trick here, because Saturday afternoons we do a music programme and, you know, just inserts from Carlisle United. And I thought, you know, there's a big, you know, listenership for Carlisle United. And I said, look, if the club let me travel with them on the team bus to cut down costs, would you be happy with us doing commentary of Carlisle United? My manager said yes, if the club's agreeable. And the manager at the time at Carlisle, he was agreeable. And so it started in 92. I started travelling with the Carlisle United team and doing full commentary of every Carlisle game. We did one Carlisle game previous to that. In 1990, Carlisle United were flying high in the then Division 4. And my hometown team, Exeter, were flying high as well. And the two met at Brunton Park in February. And we decided to do commentary of that game. So that technically was my first football commentary. Carlisle won it 1-0. But as it happened then, Nigel Saddington was the captain of Carlisle. You might remember Nigel because he played at Sunderland as a youngster. Sadly, he's gone. But that night, Carlisle won. Looked like they were going to get promoted. The wheels came off because Nigel Saddington got injured. Exeter went on to win the league that year, and Carlisle fell apart. They basically, not getting promotion was that classic scenario. They didn't get promotion. Then Virgil going part-time. Looked like they were going to fold, go out of business, and Michael Knighton arrived. So I started commentating then at Carlisle. So that's where the journey effectively
began.
You're
still over the northwest, though.
Yep. I was at Carlisle. I covered Carlisle for 7 seasons. The 7th season, I fell out with Michael Knighton, big time. And he banned me, he threw me off the team bus. And we had a very awkward relationship for most of the 97-98 season.
What so was that for then, Barnes?
Basically, he fell out with Mervyn Day, the manager. He bugged all the telephones and knew, was listening in on conversations. Yeah. So I'd obviously be on the phone to Merv about this or that. And we probably said things about Michael Knighton, didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. So he sat Mervyn Day after a relatively good start to the season. Yeah. Wasn't far. Funny enough, ironically, it was Clark Carlisle who scored at Blackpool to lose Mervyn Day his job. So Michael Knighton basically sat Mervyn, Peter Hampton, the physio. He took over as manager, and it was bizarre because I then had to drive the games. The first game he was in charge of was at Wickham Wanderers, and Wickham had gone a year unbeaten at home, and Carlisle United pitch up with Michael Knighton as the manager. Michael Knighton banned all the players talking to me, caught one of them talking to me in the stand and threatened to drop him from the game, Dean Walling. And then they went, Carlisle won 4-1. I couldn't believe it. And Michael Knighton got all the players to stand in a line in the middle of the pitch to take a bow for the away fans. As he walked off the pitch, he sees me in the stand at Wickham, because you know you're very close to the pitch at Wickham. He sees me in the stand, two fingers up to me. And one of the stewards said, oh, don't worry, mate. What comes around, sort of thing. So we went through this whole season of a very fractured relationship. And I found out at the end of the season he was going to ban me, basically, full stop, from the next season. So I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do now? And as it happened, that summer of 98 was the World Cup, and myself and Ian Dennis got attachments to BBC Sport in London. So Ian at the time was the Newcastle United commentator, and we were both in London. We were doing sport for all the networks, Radio 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. So we were doing all that. And then Ian said, well, what are you doing at the end of the attachment? It was 4 months. And I said, well, I don't know, because I'm banned at Carlisle United. I'll go back to Radio Cumbria, but I'm not quite sure how that's going
to pan out. Back to the religious programmes.
No, probably would have been. So he said, well, look, I'm moving to Leeds. I'm leaving Newcastle. I'm going to Leeds. I'm going to cover Leeds United. So the Newcastle job basically is yours if you want it. So I did do an interview with the manager at the time, but I mean, it was a tick box exercise, really. So I was given the Newcastle United job. I was still living in Cumbria, and I actually spent 15 years still driving from Cumbria to Newcastle, because I had young children. That's how the move to the northeast came about. And then we got to a point where they decided to change the commentary team, because Mick Lowes, who used to cover Newcastle for Metro, he came back to the BBC. He worked there previously, but he came back to the BBC, but as a studio presenter. But they felt, the management felt that it was a waste because he was seen really as the Newcastle United, historically the Newcastle United commentator over the years. So they decided to bring him back in to do the commentary.
Because there was a period of time, wasn't there? I remember growing up where the commentary would be with Metro for the Sunderland games, and then Sun FM had it one
season.
And
we only had second half commentary for a lot of years.
Yes, that was bizarre. Yeah,
which is really strange. They used to put together a highlights packet for half time, and then you'd do second half commentary, which was ridiculous.
That.
I don't know why that was ever agreed, but eventually that did come to an end. So they decided, right, we're going to take you off Newcastle. And poor hapless Martin Emerson was covering Sunderland, was taken off Sunderland. They put me in his place. So Martin used to commentate with Nick Pickering. And I thought, well, if I'm starting on with Sunderland, I need a fresh start. I need a fresh team, if you like. And I knew Benno from Carlisle because he played there for 6 months when he finished at Sunderland. And he had been manager at Darlington. And I'd seen him a couple of times. Darlington beat Nottingham Forest in the League Cup, and Benno was the manager. And so I'd seen him a couple of times, and I rang him up and said, look, I'm looking for a new commentary partner, and I know you're out of work now because he left Darlington. Do you fancy it? And I don't know if he did or not, but we said we'll give it a try at Kilmarnock, which is a pre-season friendly before the start of the 2003-04 season. And there you go. Haven't looked back.
I guess I'd like to know, from a commentator's point of view, is there anything different now to the method of your approach to commentary as it was then?
No, I think that's one thing that's timeless. You've got a way of working, and I've worked that way from the start. Benno will tell you. I must drive him up the wall because I always get to games like 3 hours early.
Yeah.
So we'll pitch up in League One, it was very testing for him. I remember we turned up at Port Vale, and Benno wanders off to look for the press room, and he can't find the press room, and he can't find anybody. He finally finds a cleaner, and he says to the cleaner, where's the press room? The cleaner just looks at him and asks, like, what? And then he says, oh, there's a room over there, there's a cupboard over there. So Benno goes into his cupboard, and there was like a boiler with not even a cup, and he came. I found him standing forlornly in the middle of the concourse, just lost. And that was the lost years. The 4 years in League One were Benno's lost years because I do feel for him because it's difficult. You know, you pitch up wherever and there's no facilities and you're having to sit around and wait for the programme to start.
On that note as well, then, Barnsley, obviously, me and Frankie, we don't go to away games. We covered it from the Stadium of Light for, obviously, on the Gantry home games, and studio for the away games. For yourselves, you're obviously travelling. Which are the testing grounds for yourselves? Maybe like Loftus Road, I'm guessing, where it's proper tight on top of it and, you know,
Loftus Road was awkward when we used to be on the gantry. Well, originally we used to be in the press box because the press box is in the main stand at Loftus Road, but then they moved the radio across to the other side of the ground and put us on a TV gantry.
It's
but
not
you
up
know,
a ladder.
Like you said,
ladder,
and, no, not oh. Thankfully not. I'll tell you about a ladder. Yeah. I'll tell you about Swansea City. I'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah, so we were put on the TV gantry, but you know, like you say, Loftus Road is really tight.
Yeah.
So the TV gantry literally hangs over the touchline.
Does, yeah.
So you can't. So when the ball goes out below you, you couldn't see the ball go out, and you couldn't see them take the throw in. You had to lean right out over the gantry. One of us is going to pitch over here at one point. So thankfully they. And then if you sat down, the metal bar of the gantry was across your whole vision. You couldn't see the pitch. So thankfully they've moved now, and we're down below the gantry in a bespoke press box for the radio at Loftus Road. So that's not too bad. Swansea City, when they played at the Vetch. I was there with Carlisle once, and the radio position, you had to go up a ladder up the stanchion, and it had a guard round it, and you went out onto a little gantry. It was tiny, and could fit two of you on this little gantry up the stanchion in the home fans. So you're up this stanchion, and they shake the home fans, get the ladder, shake the ladder. And then during the game, I had one of the Carlisle players as the summariser, and the home fans catch on that it's a Carlisle player.
Yeah.
Just dog's abuse all game, levelled at poor old Lee Peacock, who was up on the gantry. And he was like reluctant to come down until everybody had left the stand, because the same thing again, shake the ladder for what it's worth as you're trying to come down it, with your equipment as well.
I'd hear that.
So that was a bit
What
bit
about
surreal.
Some old grounds with obscured views? Goodison Park?
Goodison's like... horrible because the press box is really small.
Yeah.
And you're jammed in, your knees are up against the electrics. There's barely any room to move, and you're right behind you with the Everton fans. Mm-hmm. And at times they used to bang you on the back of the head. And there was one lad who used to sort of, if something happened, he'd slap you around the back of the head when you're doing the commentary.
I suppose you have to apologise to the listeners.
And you can hear the language, yeah. And you're doing that. And then and at half time, this guy would be, it was like Jekyll and Hyde. Yeah, Dad, sorry, yeah, Dad. Do you want a sweetie? You want to go, go on. And you think, and then second half, starting off again, bang, oh, whoa. So that Goodison's challenging. I mean, they're at Fulham's. I love going to Fulham. I like Fulham's, such an old-fashioned ground.
Yeah.
But the side you sit on, if the sun's up, it's right in your face.
You can't see.
So you're trying, and you can't see a thing. All you've got is the sun blaring just in your eyes, and it's really, really difficult to see.
Is that the stand behind the dugouts?
That new stand is just been opened, and we're still in the old stand.
Right.
So that was really challenging if it was a sunny day.
What about the best grounds then to commentate?
The best grounds are obviously, I mean,
who looks after you the best? Is that key to
good commentary? Manchester City and Chelsea is deemed to be the doyen for the press.
4 hours
early
for that. And you know it's the doyen when John Cook, the kit manager, and the others come in for their food in the press room. Because the food at Chelsea, it's like a fine dining restaurant.
Right.
You get two or three courses, main courses. Lavish spread of desserts, and then a lavish spread of sweets, cheese board, the works. Then they used to serve alcohol before the game, free of charge. I mean, I never drank. I don't drink before a game, but there were those that did.
Who's drinking before a game?
Yeah, well, it's not unknown. I won't name names.
Anyway,
one of the journalists did get really drunk one day and start abusing the manager.
Oh no!
The Chelsea manager. So they took alcohol off the menu, if you like, at Chelsea. But Chelsea really look after you. Manchester City, when they opened the Etihad, decided to try and trump Chelsea, and so their spread was magnificent for a couple of years, but then they sort of reined it in a bit. And Chelsea again has taken over. Arsenal used to be really good as well. You used to get your fridge full of free ice cream. Ben and Jerry's it was, I think, originally.
Wow.
So, again, and Arsenal, their press room is enormous. And the story goes that Amanda, who was the press officer at the time when they built the Emirates, they said to her, look, what ideally would you want for the press, for the media in the Emirates? And she felt, I'll ask for every single thing that I possibly want, because then I might get half of what I want.
Mm-hmm.
They gave her everything.
Really?
They really put... Yeah, so that's why Arsenal's... press media setup. I mean, the media theatre is like a small, like a small cinema and a small theatre. A repertory company anywhere in the country would be proud to go on a little stage at Arsenal because it's such a good, and they've got nine radio rooms, massive working area in the main press room.
Which grounds have the best position to commentate for?
Well, Arsenal's good. Arsenal's good because
Wembley good.
Wembley's good. Well, Wembley's it's good. I mean, although you are you're halfway through one half rather than on the halfway line. Aston Villa went at one point. They took out all the seats in the middle of the main stand, and they put the press box there. It was magnificent, and their food was fantastic. It was brilliant. For one season only, because they then realised, of course, they're the top seats.
Yeah.
They can get prime.
So they
moved the press box right down the end where the tunnel is at Aston Villa. So you're right down one end in the corner where the players come out from the dressing rooms. So that's not great.
Yeah.
Plymouth Argyle, one year, they were redeveloping Home Park and they put us behind the goal in sort of.
Are you a big fan of watching games from behind the
goal? No, it doesn't. I was mentioning rugby league earlier. I was doing a rugby league game once at Whitehaven. And I'd gone on the pretext I was only going to be doing updates for Radio Cumbria, but then the Sheffield station, whose team was playing, it was a Challenge Cup match, phoned up and said, "We've lost one of our games. We need full commentary of the game from Whitehaven." Okay, I'll do it from behind the posts. Nightmare.
Yeah.
And then that was just magnified tenfold when the Sheffield amateur rugby league team came out with no numbers on their backs.
Oh no.
Nightmare.
Yeah.
Nightmare. And that happened at Sunderland pre-season when Harrogate Town played a pre-season game at the Stadium of Light.
Yeah.
About half an hour, you remember this? Half an hour before kickoff or something, the press officer said, "Look, I don't want to worry you, but I've got a funny feeling our team haven't got any numbers." And sure enough, Harrogate run out in yellow shirts with no numbers. But he was a godsend because he said, "I'll tell you what, this is the formation I think they'll play in. He's ginger. He's got a beard. He's this."
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I pieced together who was playing and who was playing where.
It's difficult for you, obviously. We're halfway line behind the dugout to a good position. So, you're in the top tier. And at the time, it's too high. Stripy kits coming to the stadium. Difficult.
It's horrible. I mean, Sheffield Wednesday the other week at Hillsborough. We were quite a long way up. You're quite a long way up, but we couldn't read the numbers. Red on blue and white stripes.
Yeah.
Just impossible.
There's worse. You could not read them. Yellow on white. I think we've seen.
Well,
this,
in the Sunderland, there's the Sunderland white on yellow. Thankfully, that's changing because they're going to play that. They're going to wear the yellow kit at Stoke on Saturday, but it's going to be dark blue numbers. But it's not so bad. Sunderland's fine because you recognise the player. The only two that are a bit of a nightmare is Job and Burstow. Because they look similar stature. If you're sat at the top of the West Stand at the Stadium of Light, you've really got to be looking out who's wearing what colour boots today between those two, because because they interchange their positions. It's difficult.
Danny mentioned the amount of managers you've seen through the door at Sunderland, but I imagine it's a tightrope you have to work with, Nick, because you, in some ways, you're colleagues with them in a way, because you have to work with them sometimes 2, 3, 4 times a week. You've got to get material out of them for copy, don't you, and for air. So I guess at times you find yourself in a position where if Sunderland are in a negative space where you've got pressure from the fans and supporters, the listeners of BBC Radio Newcastle who want answers about certain things, but also you know that that manager perhaps can't give you those answers as well. So there's lots of different factors going on there, isn't there? Tell us about your position.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because when things aren't going very well, we get battered on social media. Not just me, the lads on the papers. It's, why aren't you asking this? Why aren't you asking him that? You're not doing your jobs. But you're right, we have a relationship with the managers. We're not like the national journalists who can just pitch up once a month and they can throw whatever they like at the manager, because they know they're not going to come back for however many games. We're there, as you say, every week, 2 or 3 times, 4 times a week. And you have a relationship. You've got to have a relationship with the manager, because otherwise you just won't get anything. Mm-hmm. And COVID, you know, that was a nightmare period because everything was done on Zoom. With Lee Johnson, we didn't build up any sort of relationship, really. There was no real rapport with him. And I think, you know, that's quite telling. You can probably, because when you are building a relationship with the manager, you get to know their moods, their personalities, what they will talk about, what they won't talk about. Tony Mowbray is very, very good, because he said to us only a few weeks ago that he was talking about the relationship between him and myself, James on the Chronicle and Phil on the Sunderland Echo, and how a year in, he says, we've built trust now and I respect you. You show me respect, but don't feel that you can't ask any questions. So in the next few weeks, months, whether you have to ask difficult questions, ask the questions. That's fine. I've not got a problem with it. Now, Alex Neil, you know, when you go back to Alex Neil's time, he was very prickly to start with.
He fell out with you for a bit, didn't he?
He would be very, what would be the right word? Not patronising, but he would give you short,
brisk. He was guarded.
Didn't like questions, would throw them back at you. But because we were back into seeing each other face to face and press conferences, that relationship warmed, and we actually were fine. You know, we had a very good relationship at the end, to the point at which I sort of instinctively knew at Stoke that day that he was going. Didn't know it was going to happen in the way that it did. But the very fact that he came down, did a separate interview with me, shook my hand afterwards, which he'd never done before, and said, thank you.
So the last time
that happened was David Moyes at Chelsea came out and saw Phil Smith and I and said, thank you, goodbye, shook our hands, got on the bus, and both knew that was David Moyes saying goodbye. So, but you only know that because you've built up over a period of time the ticks and how the manager works, and that's what you've got to do. You've got to trust them, they have to trust you, and you have to have that mutual respect. When Roy Keane walked in, the first thing he said to us was, if you respect me, I'll respect you.
Is that what he said to you as well, Danny?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Along those lines. So out of the 20 or so, who's been the most awkward? Has anyone pulled you off mic, so to speak, to have a quiet word, give you a bit of a grilling? Or
I've never been... only one manager pulled me to one side. Only one manager pulled me to one side in all those managers. I don't know if you can guess. it's more recent.
Phil Parkinson.
Really?
Phil Parkinson, because he thought we pre-season game at Gateshead, first pre-season game that I'd been to. I think it was the first pre-season game at Gateshead. And it was an awful game. One goal and it went through the goalkeeper's legs. And I was doing an interview with Phil afterwards, knowing that this wasn't a whole, the interview wasn't going to go out as a whole interview, because we didn't have a sports programme on air at the time. It was going to be used for clips for the breakfast show and everything. So my first question was, look, you can't legislate for a ball going through the goalkeeper's legs. Did the interview, didn't think any more of it. Get a message then for the next home game. Phil wants a word with you. Had to go down pitch side at the Stadium of Light to see Phil.
Pre-kickoff.
And he said, that interview, you're negative. You're really negative. And in fairness, he said, I've listened to a few of your commentaries, you and Benno, and I think you're negative. And
how was he listening to them?
He must have listened back on on
BBC
whatever,
Sounds.
BBC Sounds. And but anyway, he said, I'm going to phone Benno and I'm going to speak to Benno. He never has. And but he pulled me and he said to me, I've got no problem with you because I think your coverage is fair, but I do think that was negative at Gates said. And our relationship was never quite the same after that.
Right.
And then I'm sure because watching him, the way he reacted in press conferences from then on, I think you knew he was under pressure. He was putting pressure on himself. He walks out with that clipboard, didn't he? And he used to walk out pre-match with a clipboard, walk round the whole of the pitch and came. At Fleetwood, he came out in front of us because we were there early, as we always are. And we were sat in the stand and Phil Parkinson pulled out two players. I think Carl Winchester might be one. Anyway, he pulls out two players in front of us, clearly telling them in front of us, you're not playing today, lads. Yeah. Which I thought was humiliating for the players. I thought that's no place to do it. You should be doing that in the dressing room. And so those two lads were well cheesed off. Anyway, he lost his job after that. But, you know, again, you knew something wasn't right. You knew something. Phil Parkinson wasn't the same Phil Parkinson he had been this previous season. Jack Ross, bless him, who I got on really, really well with, lovely, lovely bloke. You knew in that second season things weren't quite right with him.
Mm.
And he'd had conversations with us, actually, that he'd looked to leave in the summer and his father persuaded him to stay. So you knew there wasn't, you know, that was the background. It's not a bed of roses this season. And so there was, and you could sense by his answers. And he's slightly, in the same way, I guess, as Phil Parkinson was, he was slightly within himself and he was a bit more guarded and things aren't quite right here. And you only knew that because you were seeing them three or four times a week and you knew how their personality, if you like, was changing over a period of time. And Lee Johnson, the same. You knew that it was going that way.
Do you think those managers you're obviously mentioning there, coming into Sunderland in League One, know they're up against it, so to speak, straight away?
There's massive pressure on them. I mean,
that was such a weird time.
It was a horrible, horrible time. And I felt for Jack Ross because he was, he was two results away from achieving.
And he inherited the worst squad.
And he did. And so he had to deal with all that. Yeah. So he had to deal with all that. Expectation was through the roof because everybody assumed it would be 87, 88, all over again, straight back up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then everyone got on his back because of all the draws. And he got very defensive. He got very defensive with me about, you know, he said, I'm not defensive. I don't play defensive. I'm playing to win. But you could clearly see that Wembley final first when second half they'd gone defensive. And so he had all that to deal with. And yet, you know, two games in the season where they conceded late goals. And if they won those two games, where would we be now? It might be a completely different story because Sunderland could well have been back in the Championship within a season and we wouldn't have had the 4 years in League One.
Yeah, but these things sometimes happen for a reason.
As Tony Mowbray would say, that's football, it is what it is.
And I guess Tony Mowbray must be up there with some of the characters that you've got
brilliant.
On with the most.
Absolutely brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And I haven't met a single person who hasn't, you know, everybody's got a good thing to say about
him. You've obviously got BBC colleagues within the industry who's worked with Tony before,
they love him, absolutely love him. You talk to the lads from Borough, and they are so envious that we've got Tony Mowbray.
It's quite open as well.
Yeah, totally, because he's so good to deal with. He's just he's a genuine human being, understands what we need, understands what the players need, understands how it all works.
Do you think it's important that he understands the region as well?
I think, and that is, he gets it. I mean, even by his own admission, he said, I didn't realise how big Sunderland was. He said, I got here and I knew they're up the road and I knew they're a big club. He said, I didn't really realise quite how big this football club is.
That's interesting, coming from Tony.
Which coming from someone who's grown up in the North East.
Players coming into the club as well, the foreign boys, isn't it?
It's quite interesting. And that's the whole, you know, when you go, I mean, Steve Bruce used to talk about the players and the expectations on them. And the classic one, of course, is Craig Gardner and how he struggled to deal with the demands placed on him as a Sunderland player compared to the demands placed on him as a Birmingham City player, where he said at Birmingham, the expectation was just to stay in the Premier League. Anything else as a bonus.
Yeah.
Moves to Sunderland and everything's like, you know, suddenly magnified and you've got to deal with that. I mean, I think Steve Bruce used to say at Sunderland, if you're a Brentford player, I think was the analogy, you can make 8 mistakes and then the crowd will get on your back. At Sunderland, you can make 1 mistake and the crowd's on your back. And that's what players find difficult. I mean, Danny can speak better than I about this, but, you know, I've spoken to players since and the young players at Sunderland now who do play with a lot of, you know, there's no fear. I mean, I chatted to Dan Neil about it, and Dan, of course, he said, well, it's maybe different for me because I'm a Sunderland fan. I used to stand on the terrace and give the players the same abuse that we're getting.
Probably Danny abuse.
So he sees it slightly differently. But if you take a player, I don't know, like a Jack Clark or someone like that, there must be a lot. The burden of expectation on them now must be vast.
Yeah.
Must be heavy.
Yeah. In your time, though, you've seen some Sunderland squads. How far up does this Sunderland squad rank in how good it is?
I think it's one of the best. We've had this debate on the programme about, is this a better team than last year? And my personal feeling is that it is. I think it's got more balance.
More people in the positions.
In the right positions, if they can keep them injury free. And I think there is a bit more now, a little bit more strength in depth. I think once you get Mattetti, Evans, Elise,
strikers going.
And I think they'll find their feet. I think overall, and where they were this time last season compared to where Sunderland are this season, that in itself, I think, tells a story. You know, already they're in the top 6.
Yeah.
Whereas it took them quite a long time to achieve that last season.
Because after last year, you're thinking, how are they going to go now next year?
And especially losing Ahmad and Ross Stewart.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, which isn't, you know, Ross Stewart, we never really saw. Ahmad wasn't our player. And I always think there's a problem with that because you think, God, we've got this fantastic player. Oh, he's going back next. So you've now got a squad which is pretty much Sunderland. You know, they are here. They are ours. They're not going anywhere. And I think that gives you some stability moving forward, some momentum. And the football's brilliant at times. They'll have aberrations like Middlesbrough, but the referee didn't help in that situation.
Is the football style the best football style you've seen as some commentator?
Brilliant. I mean, I know people refer back to Peter Reid and when they had the wingers, and so there was some fantastic football then. But in the 20 years that I've been doing it with Benno, this is the best football I've seen. Some of it is just mesmerising.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even our time, a couple of promotions from this league, but it was more so perhaps a standard 4-4-2. Now everything's changed, hasn't it? No one really plays a 4-4-2. Everybody wants to play out from the back. I know at times you can hear the fans in the ground. They get a little bit nervy, don't they, when we're trying to play out into Luke and the other centre-backs and play through the thirds. But some of the football's...
No, it's great to watch. I mean, and that's attracting a whole new audience, isn't it? I mean, you look at how... I mean, it's like a team of pop stars, isn't it, now, when they arrive at the stadium on a Saturday and they're all the kids wanting autographs. And I'm sure they were for Danny back in the day, but...
Hey, they still do when we're coming out. Lots of times he gets bothered.
But you know, when they've had the open training sessions at the Stadium of Light, 4,000 people turn up, and the buzz is fantastic. And you know, the players, you know, that generation, you want to bring them in and keep them. And this football team at the moment is doing that because of the football it's playing and what they're achieving. Are they overachieving? It's so hard to say because they're such a young team.
It's quite topical because of our last guest as well, but does the ownership have something to do with that as well?
Maybe? Yeah, I think clearly it does, because it's a model where it's based on, I mean, it's a gamble, I suppose, because untried, and you've got to hope, and it'll be tested every transfer window. And you know that, you know, we had a test, if you like, this summer with Jack Clark and, to a certain extent, Patrick Roberts.
There was chat about Dan Neil as well.
Dan Neil. So it was tested, but no, and clubs dipped their feet in the water. But
it may be tested again in
January. And it will be tested again in January. But I think, you know, if the club is intent on this model, they've got to hold their nerve and say, and that's why I think, you know, they're giving the players longer term contracts, because they know it builds security for the club as much as it does for the player, but more for the club, because it means that they can turn round to a Premier League club in January and say, no, he's got another 3 years on his contract, he's going nowhere, he's part of this plan, we've got 5 years to get back to the Premier League. It looks at the moment like they might achieve that sooner than 5 years because of the way the team's playing and where they are in the table. And you've got to applaud Kirill Louis-Dreyfus and Christian Speakman, but also Stuart Harvey. Take my hat off to Stuart Harvey. Yeah. The miles, the distance, the travel he is doing to unearth these players is remarkable.
And despite what people say on social media, I can't imagine many of our fans have heard of some of these players.
No way. I mean, whereas Stuart, Tony said last week, oh, Stuart's off again next week, packed his bag, he's away. Japan, South really? America, Europe. Yeah. I mean, who is he going to find in Japan?
Who knows?
All of a sudden I'm going to find, we get, you know, someone who's never heard of,
yeah,
19 years old, whatever. But, I mean, they're finding them. I mean, they are finding these players at the minute. And you know, you say we've got Ukrainians, we've got French. I mean, French, we've got quite a few French. Spanish. I mean, suddenly it is becoming a lot more cosmopolitan.
Yeah. Danny, how is that, though, to integrate in a dressing room when you've got people from different nationalities? But it sounds that, well, from what Nick's saying, though, everyone's fighting for the cause at the moment. That helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, obviously, the age groups are all similar. You mentioned it there. I think Jefferson Bennett's someone who you didn't mention there. Language barrier becomes a part of it. I know, obviously, Julio was in, wasn't he?
Yeah.
A season or so ago, helping out. Yeah, but I think when you're in a good place, which the club are, and the lads are enjoying their football, you can see that, you know, we've said it there in terms of young lads. If it gets a bit tough in the stadium, it can get hostile, but they look like they're playing with the freedom.
They do seem to, yeah. I mean, they all say there's a very good group, and seem to be tight knit. I mean, and I think Tony Mowbray made a good point actually 2 weeks ago. I think he said the foreign lads, they will have to start learning English. They've got to. He says, I want that to happen sooner rather than later, because I'm not, if they're not learning English and they're not understanding what I'm trying to impart to them, if they're not taking it in, they're not going to play. So it's in their best interest to get up to speed with the language. To get themselves in the team, and I thought, well, okay, that's fine. That's coach. You're the man. You're the coach. You've got these players, but the tools are useless if they can't understand half the job, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
because you're out there, aren't you? You've got your general football language, so to speak.
And to a certain extent, you can.
As you say,
but there are. It's more. And now you know how the way the team is set up.
Yeah.
It's much, much more
complex,
sophisticated and complex than it used to be. So these players need to be taking these things, which would be fascinating. I mean, I must ask Tony Mowbray actually this week, what was on the note?
Oh, yeah, the note.
What's going around the team. And
getting the
Middlesbrough
chippy
game.
Order in, wasn't
that? That was so funny, that one. Not sure what happened to it in the end.
Yeah, well.
Someone said Luke and I probably ate it.
Probably, knowing him. It's tradition, Nick, on SFC Unfiltered, for Danny to set up a quiz. You went on the last podcast, Danny, but you have returned with the quiz Nick. Now, just for relevance and context of the scores, it's out of five. I think the best ever might have been Lyndon Gooch. Did he get five out of five?
Really?
Yeah.
Been sweet for Lyndon.
Yeah. Worst ever was Christian Speakman.
I'll be with him on that one, I'm sure.
Well, let's see. Let's see. Here we go, then.
Yeah. Mixed bag. Barnsley. General knowledge.
Oh.
Obviously, they're only easy if you know the answers. But the first one we'll go for, and I think you like a little drop of whiskey now and then, I believe.
I do,
correct, yeah. But so which celebrity was buried with a bottle of whiskey, a bottle of Jack Daniels back in the day? Do you know this one?
Jack Daniels. Oh, it's got to be a rock star of some sort. I would guess someone from the rock world. I would say Lemmy from Motorhead, but...
I was going to go back to sort of one of the Victorian writers of
Huckleberry
Finn or someone like that.
I'm thinking more 60s
you're more
now,
in the,
actually.
The ballpark.
I'm not allowed to help you.
Orson Welles.
Right, if that's your guess, Orson Welles, I'm going to guess Jim Morrison.
It was Frank Sinatra.
Really?
Oh, Frank Sinatra, yeah.
I wouldn't have got that.
Been straight on that one.
Alfie Joy would have gotten that.
All I will say, though, is Jack Daniels is grain whiskey rather than single malt.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's bourbon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it come up in the whiskey question.
So if it had been a bottle of single malt,
if it was a Scotch-based question, you might get that. Yeah,
okay. Question number two.
Naught out of one. Yeah. Going well, isn't it?
Yeah, good start. Football, back to football. I've chucked one in. Who's the first foreign manager to win the FA Cup? Do you need a clue? Do you want a year on it? Or do you want to
give us a decade? Foreign...
Well, we're in the 90s.
First foreign manager.
Late 90s.
Not Arsene Wenger.
Not Arsene Wenger. No, Ruud Gullit, Chelsea.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would have gone Wenger.
Would you?
Mm-hmm.
They beat Borough 2-0, Chelsea.
Did they? No. Right.
I think Di Matteo score early. Was that the one?
Was that that one?
The crossbar, maybe.
Naught out of two.
Come on, Nick.
I'm with you, Christian.
Geography now. But geography.
Oh, heavens, field, right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you like your Wainwright and things like that? Yeah. That's geographical. You
know, it is. Sort of. It is. Right. Small, small geographical area.
Well, country, landlocked country. Which country is landlocked by Germany, France and Belgium?
Luxembourg.
Yeah, I would say that.
You got that? Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Luxembourg.
There well done. He's off the mark.
Whew. Off and running.
Ever been to Luxembourg?
No. Can't think I'm likely to either.
You never know.
Cars next. Cars.
Oh, no.
What do the initials BMW stand for?
I've been to Munich and looked across the BMW factory from the Olympic Stadium.
So you know it.
But I don't know it. Something, the middle one must be motor.
Correct.
And the... But it's not Bayern motor wheels.
Oh, do you know it?
Is it works?
It's works, yeah. Bavarian Motor Works.
There
yeah.
we go.
I should have guessed that. Motorworks. Munich's in Bavaria, yeah.
You don't drive a BMW then?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Have you seen my car?
Yeah, I've seen your car.
My partner, she'd just laugh when I got it.
It's a Sunderland car.
It's on brand. It's on brand.
It's got red and white stripes for the listeners.
Someone who will remain nameless, Phil Smith, that's on an Echo, said, I always know when you've got to the academy before me because you're ridiculous cars, partner.
I can't talk about ridiculous cars. Carry on with the quiz.
Anyway, yeah, sorry.
So last one. Eugene Cernan was the last person to do what in 1972?
Walk on a tightrope across the something falls, Victoria Falls.
Do you know what? I thought he had it when he started off there. Eugene Cernan was the last person in 1972 to walk on the moon.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You were onto something there, though, because you said...
Walk on a tightrope. Yeah.
I wouldn't have gotten that.
I should have stopped halfway through. I should have walked. I should have walked. And Danny should have jumped in. Yes, that's right.
Half a point. 1 out of 5, Barnsley. You finished above Christian.
Yeah.
Positive to take
from that.
Linden. I doff my cap to Linden Gooch.
Yeah. Now, of course, of Stoke City. And Danny, your former club as well. Sunderland's next game. Barnsley's 1,000th game. We'll come on to that in a second, Nick. But, you know, do you think Sunderland have got the edge on this going into it?
Yeah, I fancy them. I fancy us if we turn up. We're more than a handful for anyone in the league. And they're having a tough time down at Stoke, aren't they? I think he's under a bit of pressure, Alex Neil. Naturally, if you're at the wrong end of the table for a club expected to be certainly pushing for the playoffs at least. So we've got to bounce back. Disappointing results, obviously, against Middlesbrough. It's one of them. Put it to bed. We've had a break, which has come at the right time. And I think get ready to go again. And hopefully one or two back from the treatment room.
Yeah, Nick.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah,
you...
I'd agree. I think, I mean, looking at Stoke, they're all over the place at the moment. And I think, you know, they've clearly got, I mean, the same way that Sunderland have a problem playing at home, I think Stoke have got a problem playing at home as well. And there's bound to be tension there with the start they've made. I mean, I was looking last week after they lost to Leicester last time out. I think they had 9 players injured. And you can see that's reflected in the team that he's picking at the minute. And there may be one or two of those back. But it clear, and he's had a whole sort of, there's been a sea change in the playing personnel over the summer because they weren't able to when he first went there because of the transfer embargo. But they've got rid of a whole lot of players. They brought in a lot of players. So they're going through a transformative period, which I suspect is why, and because he gets on so well, Alex Neil, with the owners.
He's going to have time to turn it around.
They will give him time. Yeah. But it is taking time, obviously, for him to gel.
The game will be your 1,000th game covering Sunderland, and it couldn't happen at a nicer place. One of those stadiums, kind of newer, older stadiums.
It's the coldest, windiest.
Yeah, it comes in there, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Whatever the weather, it's always cold.
Yeah. Have you got any lines prepared or anything like that?
No, I never do that. I don't. I know there are commentators always have prepared line. Yeah, I mean, we are just random.
I was going to say, yeah, I put it on the notes there, the old artwork notes, Sabuto players. I do all those, when did you start doing that? The Sunderland days?
Ooh,
or?
Sunderland days, yeah.
Was it?
They were sort of gradually, it was gestating into that way I do it. And then it's really, yeah, since covering Sunderland, it's really grown. It's blossomed into that.
So when would you prep for start of Wednesday, Thursday time?
I do
really?
Straight after the last game. Yeah. I'll do start doing it.
Right.
And then through the week a bit more, yeah, and then sort of polish it off, yeah, Thursday, Friday.
It's a bit hectic when we have a midweek.
So
as well,
it's difficult. Yeah, I try and get ahead of the game because of, especially if it's two away games, the travel as well. So I try and get ahead of myself. But always remember Anton Ferdinand used to have it on his arm, tattooed on his arm. Fail to prepare, prepare to fail.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the adage. You know, you might never use anything that you've got written down, yeah, but it's there if you need it. It's a crutch if you need it.
Yeah. Do you have the same research sources for
I always use the same, pretty much. Always try and use two or three sources just to double check on things, because you can not necessarily... I mean, you'd be amazed sometimes at some of the rubbish that gets put up about players, and you think...
Some of the different sites have different formations. Are
different heights, different ages.
Different previous clubs,
everything. Yeah. So it's nice to double check.
And do you ever check in with your BBC colleagues around the regions?
Yeah, we tend to. Yeah, I mean, especially more on the day of the game, I tend to sort of get a heads up. Well, is this likely to be the team, or is that? I mean, we always on the programme as well have a opposition lowdown, if you like. So the commentator or whoever from the away comes on, and you get another feel for what's happening.
Yeah,
at the club.
All right, then. I think we're done. On behalf of everyone at Sunderland Football Club, Nick, thanks for covering us. And personally speaking as well, thanks for all those games before I start working match days. I'm sure there'll be some kind of gold plaque or something waiting for you at the next home game. But until then, Nick, we'll see you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.